I'm Bill Lennon, and I'm going to do about a five-minute catch-up of some things from yesterday, and either bore those of you that were here, or remind you and say, is that what we talked about? I'll be darned. As it works at Holden, I'm working at doing each presentation as some piece that will stand alone, but also I'm doing a full week of things that are connected, and so I'm putting some energy into trying to make both of those things work. Yesterday, I talked a little bit about some of my background as a marriage, child, and family therapist and a director of a clinical psychology program, and then my move in 1979 into working with a family incest treatment program and over coffee in the lift. That would be an interesting story, how I backed into that. I mean, that was just kind of crazy, but I've been doing that. And that's pretty significant for people in clinical positions. It's not so much for other folks that don't even pay attention to things like incest and stuff like that unless it comes crashing home. But I go to court quite a bit now, and people will always ask you in court what training you had when you began. And 10 years ago, when you started working there, there was no training. You either figured out how to do it, this is the whole thing of incest, and whether it's in a family or the same dynamic that I talked about yesterday in a church or in a school or in a workplace, it's really so new what we do about it, how we treat it. But I talked some about the dynamic of an offender, of a non-offending partner, and of a victim, and that the victim is always in the context that I'm referring to, the victim is always vulnerable, and the offender is always one who uses power, and that that's the chief difficulty to deal with, both in a corporate sense, in a body, and also with the offender. I'm going to talk Friday more about victims and the dynamics of victims, and that really is different. But when we're talking about healing the corporate body or doing some work with the offender, it's crucial to look at the process. And I gave some examples of that just crashed home to me a few years ago, that as horrible as the incident is that may happen, it's the thing that's the worst is not so much what is touched or what is not touched or for how long it, whatever it is done, but the fact that here's a person who I am vulnerable to, who I give power to in what I call a legitimate dependency. I think children have a right to have parents who set boundaries and don't cross sexual lines. I think parishioners have a right to have, I get in trouble with that sometimes, but I happen to believe that very strongly, that that it is okay to be in some ways legitimately dependent on some people for some things. And then we talk about people who, for their own reasons, choose to cross those boundaries and abuse those particular problems. So we talked some about those things yesterday, and at least I looked at myself and I said, okay, if you don't get anything else out of anything, it's either too overwhelming or too whatever. I wanted everybody to walk out with an action step or an action process. So for me yesterday, I wrote down the key construct that I wanted you to get was that break the secret individually and in a corporate sense. But that's not easy to do. In a corporate sense, if it's in a church body or a school group or whatever, there are hundreds of reasons why people will convince you not to totally break the secret. Let's just fire them and get them out of here. Let's do. And that typically happens. And I want to at least threaten you with and empower you with and say that you'll pay a greater price by doing that than if you... The example I think of a lot is a sore that's got pus in it. You just can't scab it over and let it go. There's a lot of cleaning and cleansing that has to be done. And my experience over and over is that it has to get a whole lot worse before it gets better, but then it has a chance to get better. It really, really does have a chance for healing. So breaking secrets for the individual, for the corporate group, that's my message. And if you're involved in any kind of situation, or here, or Aunt Sadie writes from Minneapolis and says, guess what? And say, well, I heard this guy say, take it all away. Break the secrets. Get it out in the open. I also mentioned yesterday that out of some statistics, and I can, you know, what's they're crazy anyway, and I don't even know what statistics mean, but we think a couple of them that I'd like you to be aware of, if you're not already aware of, is that probably 35% of females are in our society have been assaulted in a sexual way by the time they're 18, and that probably 1 in 25 males cross sexual boundaries in a sexual misconduct kind of way. And that's that's really valid. We can back those kinds of figures up. I would guess they're stronger than that. And at another time I'll talk more about females and offending, but I'm not going to get into that today. My guess is, just a wild guess, if we want to get a little controversial, that there are probably as many female offenders as there are males. That's my guess. I don't think there's anything specific about sexual offending that only males do that. I think there are a whole lot of things in our culture which make it more subtle, and there's something, but I don't know, you know, that's too new for us. I do know this, that when I work with female offenders, the processes are exactly the same. They're no different. And the healing process is exactly the same, starting with breaking secrets. Well, I can't go back over that. I've got some different things to talk about today, but does anybody want to make a comment or ask a question or something before we launch into today's stuff? Is that the spokesman for the group?
For the female.
Okay.
Do the offender, are the victims, when you talk about secrecy, what's at stake for them? Would secrecy serve them in some respects? Or is it best for them to have it all out?
Oh, you sure did raise a tough one. Yes, sometimes it is better for them, and ultimately, and that's just a really complex question, and I think has to be dealt with individually every time. All decisions that we make, at least at our place where we have our program, we have what we call a victim-oriented program, and we make all decisions based on what's best for the victim. When I work with a rape victim, the decision will always be, I would rather prosecute, but can you take it? And if you can't take it, then we won't. So we'll always do what's... it may even be best for the victim to have everything out, but the victim may not be able to handle that. So then we have to get involved in some other kinds of things just because they just can't do it. And then we start playing crazy legal games like, well, there's a period of time, for instance, if you're getting into the legals about statute of limitations, and maybe you want to wait a year or two of therapy before you do that. But it's all got to be based on what's best for the victim, always. It's really difficult because decisions you make sometimes to help a victim are not the best for the corporate community in terms of any healing, and are sometimes, in fact, quite often, not at all the best for the offender, because it's clearly best for the offender to get everything out. Clearly best. If you ever want to get, number one, if you ever want to break the pattern so that it doesn't happen again, and number two, if you ever want to get any real healing and restoration for that person. But sometimes you can't. Well, yes, ma'am.
Did I hear you say correctly that women were just as much as the abuser
No.
At the age of 18?
No, that isn't what I said. But thanks for asking, because when I say things that come out wrong, I sure hope people question me and then let me either straighten it out or argue my point. I said earlier that statistics will show that 35% of women in our culture will have been sexually assaulted by the time they're age of 18. I later said that when I work with women offenders, totally different from that, although they may have been abused or they may not have been abused, that the statistics of adjudicated offenders that are women is much smaller, but I suspect that's not accurate, that there may be many more women offenders than... Wait, I'm starting using that. That there may be many more female offenders than we know. That's two different statements.
And they would offend against who?
Males, females, whoever, adults. I guess I have to digress for a second there. It shows my age and it dates me, and I'm sure there are many more, like Risky Business. I didn't see, but I was told it says something. But Summer of 42 was a movie that, before I got real involved in a lot of this work, I thought was just a delightful little thing, and I'm using that as an example, if any of you know that movie. But it's a movie about a young woman of 23 or 24 or something whose husband's in the Second World War, and she has a sexual contact with a 14-year-old boy. Now, that's sexual misconduct. That's molest. But societally, lots of folks I run into don't tend to think of that as molest. Whereas if you reversed that and showed a movie of a 24-year-old man whose wife has gone somewhere and he has sexual contact with a 14-year-old girl, there's no question. We move on it very rapidly. We know what to do. That's molest behavior. We have laws against that, and so forth and so on. Now, that analogy will break down, but I think there is a certain amount of that that permeates our society. There's a lot of jokes, gallows humor, in when you work in this field. By the way, I don't do this all the time. In fact, at our staff, I say that nobody can do more than 40 to 50% of this kind of work. You got to do some other stuff too, or you get... I know folks that do this kind of work who I think become very jaded, and it's just... It can suck you into it. Working with sickness can suck you into that. And I hope I'm not there, and I hope I never get there. And I hope whatever you get from me, that you still can get a sense that I have some hope and vitality, because this work can get very difficult and draw you into it. But at any rate, there'll be some gallows humor jokes about how many women ever get arrested for exposing themselves. I work with women who expose themselves. I work with men who expose themselves. Whoever arrests a woman for exposing herself? We just don't do that. You know, and so forth and so on. A lot of things in our society that we think of a young male who's 12 or 13 who has a sexual contact with a 40-year-old woman as, well, he scored, or he got started earlier. Wasn't he lucky? We reverse that, and we think of that as horrible and molest behavior. That's all I was referring to. That I think there's just a whole lot of stuff in that area that we don't know a lot about, and that will probably change in 10 or 15. This business, this whole field, this whole treatment area is so new, we hardly know what we're doing. Yes?
Have you ever worked with a boy who's been in a situation, and is there a lot of psychological impact?
Enormous psychological impact. What tends to happen with all children who are victimized, and I'm speaking then, but yesterday I tried to set a scene, and I will keep working at setting this scene, that I'm not only speaking of children, I'm also speaking of the secretary who the boss has sexual contact with, and she's 39 years old and whatever. But children who get into sexual contact like that tend to get frozen at that level in a psychosocial kind of way, and they don't move on. And so it is very damaging.
But you worked with a teenage boy who had sexual contact with a woman?
Yes, I have. Mm-hmm. It's worse a teenage boy who's had sexual contact with a male. They seem to have a harder time working through that than, and I think that's partly because just societally we say, well, you know, we kind of look the other way, wink a little bit, and say, well, look, sounds like you got some, and it wasn't that big a deal. So at least he sort of gets a little bit of, he can talk about it or brag about it or break the secret somehow. And I'll keep coming back to that. The secret thing is what kills the offender, and then he gets into his own crazy patterning as to You know, nobody gets up in the morning that I know of, or it's a metaphor that I think of. I don't know anybody that gets up in the morning and says, I think I'll go molest somebody today, or I think I'll get involved in some kind of sexual misconduct. It's kind of like gears that are moving very slowly, and there's a long, long pattern of shifting that eventually happens. Well, okay, I'm going to take this one, and I'm going to... Yes, ma'am.
What about the wife of an offender? Is she a victim? And where does she get help?
She certainly may be a victim. Melody Beattie, in her book Codependent No More, and in Schaaf's books about codependence, I think, speak well to that. A lot of things that we've learned out of the alcohol field are, a lot of the examples hold the same, but invariably the wife of an offender has the disease of codependency. And I think that, to kind of hierarchically state these, I think that the disease of codependency is insidious, it's rampant in our society. Many of us, including myself, are late coming into our life recognizing how codependent we are, how we put up with things that we can see in somebody else. We'd never put up with that, but we do it constantly ourselves. And I think that the, for instance, in Karn's books and in the work that they do at the Golden Valley in Minnesota, they say, trying not to be critical but to be observational, that if you are married to an offender or a partner to an offender, you have the disease of codependency and you've got a lot of work to do. You're not bad because you have that, but the very fact that you have remained in that relationship and that relationship has remained an offending relationship says that you are caught into that thing of I'll make it work and somehow, and also have taken on some of the issues of, at some level, some of this must be my fault, which it's not. It has nothing to do with the partner, but somehow the partner has not been sensitive enough, listened to their cues enough, drawn the lines appropriately enough. So by not doing that, you have that disease of codependency. It's a lot easier when I said hierarchically. It's so much easier with, and the concepts here are the same. If you ingest a chemical, and you ingest a chemical to a disproportionate amount that your system can handle, and you become addicted to it through tolerance, hey, like it or not, we can see that, and you can either stop it or keep it going. It's much more difficult to pick up this compulsion to eating disorders, but it's similar. It's even more difficult to pick up this compulsion to inappropriate sexual behavior, and I think even more difficult to pick up this disease of or compulsion of codependency. So I kind of put those hierarchically, and I think the one that's the most difficult to deal with is codependence. Let me just say one more thing about that. What I find, my codependency, which has just been rampant in my life, and in the last few years I'm working very, very hard at it, and it's difficult for me to work on, is that I'm a Christian, and I have been blessed with a pretty even disposition, so I don't have lots of emotional ups and downs, and I think of myself as physically pretty strong. And so what I do with that is that I usually figure I have a process of I'll make it work. I'll make things work out. And if things need to be, if you're at a party, I'm always the guy that stays and helps and does the dishes. And I may want to go home because I go to work the next day. But you know, I can kind of, and I get real codependent around that stuff. And I have a real difficult time trying to figure my Christianity and my codependence and all that kind of stuff. And golly, I go nuts trying to figure that stuff out. And I'm getting tons better. Interestingly enough, my sister-in-law says in the last 5-6 years she doesn't like me as much. I'm just using that as an example. She said, you know, you're not, there are times rather than sit and listen and be sensitive at a party and really, sometimes you'll just leave. You didn't ever used to do that. And I know, I'm learning. See, I'm learning how to break this, and I probably haven't, you know how we go with pendulums, and so at any rate. We're not here to talk about me and my battle against that, but I haven't read a good book yet. At least I haven't seen one, a good book yet, helping us on Christian codependency, and there's just a ton of problems that we get into there.
Excuse me. Can you just explain codependency in that example that you just gave of yourself? And I thought I understood the term. But
I'm not sure. Can I hold it? Yeah. Thanks for the question, but I'm afraid if I get into that, I'll never do what I'm going to do here today. But I'd love to talk about that. Maybe we can evolve something, because I'm not sure of all of it. Well, I want to talk about the process now of what happens when someone is in a corporate body, and I want to keep it away from, I want to keep it pretty generic. I want to keep it so that it isn't just adults with children, it's people in power abusive situations. So someone is vulnerable and someone is has more power than the other. And I wanted to talk about grooming and wedging, and then in a moment a little bit about victims, and then on Friday we'll talk much more about victims. But grooming and wedging, I've just defined these my own way, and I don't know if you're allowed to do that, but I did it. So I don't mean grooming like you do with your horse. Grooming is a process of breaking down barriers, becoming familiar, and desensitizing someone so as to use them sexually. The next two overheads I'll put on, I'll give you some specifics of what I mean by that. But all the way through this, there will be a point, as I talk about grooming, where you're setting someone up that it gets real tricky, because if you take it to the end, to the final move where there is sexual contact, we all recognize that. Most of us feel appalled at that, angry at that. We can see the problem with that. It's taking a look at the grooming process in an earlier context and recognize it. And that's where my theme for the second part is today. Listen to your intuition as I talk about the grooming and wedging process. That's what I'd like people to walk out of here today. Because every situation, and I'm not supposed to say every, but it's been 100% that I've worked in the last few years. When I get in a situation with a church or with a school or with a business, and there has been inappropriate cross-line sexual contact, and we start interviewing everybody and we get to do the secret breaking, there will be half a dozen people will say, I knew something was wrong. Something inside of me said that wasn't right, but they didn't listen to themselves. So I'm going to talk about grooming and wedging and ask you to listen to yourself. Now, think about this, and I'm going to ask us to do a little something with this a little later this morning. If you listened to yourself, what becomes important to do then is go to a rule-out mode. I've really listened to myself, and I've talked to a couple people, and it's okay. Or I've listened to myself, and I better pay attention to that. Did that make sense? Lots of folks just won't listen to themselves because it seems to, that couldn't be. And since it couldn't be, I'm not going to pay attention to it. But just flags are going around inside that something's not right. Grooming involves incremental steps that are progressive. Now, it'll make a little more sense when I show you the next overhead. But what I mean by that is, if I wanted to become a friend with one of you, some of you I'd love to be friends with you, I wouldn't walk up and hug you or kiss you. I would get, if I ever got to the point of hugging you and kissing you in an appropriate kind of way, I'd do incremental steps first. I'd probably say, let's go get an ice cream. You see what I'm saying? And we'd go through some steps. I was going through this with a school district vice principal, and I got about halfway through this, and he stopped me. He says, that's the way I did with every girl I ever dated. I said, correct. Grooming steps are not necessarily steps that set someone up to sexual misconduct. There's a point where it crosses a line and goes in an inappropriate kind of way. The tactics used are in many cases the same steps used in gaining a friendship. Grooming is high on objectivity. Friendship is high on empathy. Now that gets pretty subtle to pay attention to. But a lot of people will tell me, so-and-so spends time with me, but there's a difference. And if you really kind of dig down into it, sometimes that difference is that the relationship is based on things, or the relationship is based on how they think about things, not how I feel, some of that kind of stuff. So, and that gets pretty subtle, but there's a close correlation with the need-want continuum that I talked about yesterday. The offender, and I'm calling him the offender, and that's an objectionable term, and remember, if we're paying attention to internal cues, this is before any offending has gone on. But the offender is in a perceived need state, therefore low on empathy. So maybe he needs to talk to you a lot about himself or herself, or there's a whole lot of for them and not much for you. But you may be flattered by that, or you may not pick it up, so you think, well, that's all right, I guess. You don't quite know. There's a little disquieting feeling inside of you, but it's not the end of the world.
Is the offender conscious of the fact that he's going through these steps?
Sometimes yes and sometimes no. Kind of depends on how far into the process this person is. But quite often I would say not. I saw a little TV show the other night, and they said, I like you, this boy and girl, and I said, no, but do you like me? Well, it's kind of like the offender knows but doesn't know, because it's a pattern to get what they want, and so they kind of move into a, oh, this really gets spooky, but kind of an altered state of consciousness where you just sort of go into your rap. Am I making any sense there? I was working with an offender, and I was over at Nordstrom's one night in Bellevue. Isn't that where everybody goes, to Nordstrom's in Bellevue? I mean, would anybody admit openly that they go to Nordstrom's in Bellevue up at Olden Village? We were at Nordstrom's. My wife and I were in Nordstrom's one night, and I don't tell my wife about people, you know, certain things I do. And this fella came up and started talking, and he was a sex offender in a program that I work with, and he introduced himself to me, and he's very glib, and he moved into really an altered state of consciousness. I'd say within 10 minutes, he was putting a move on my wife like you wouldn't believe, and I wasn't too worried anything was going to happen, you know, but he wasn't even aware that he was doing this. He just moved into his thing. Weren't you so-and-so? Didn't you go to the U at such-and-such? And he was doing all his stuff, and it was ludicrous, and I was able to point it out to him later, and I wasn't threatened by it. And my wife thought, gee, that was a nice man. Where do you know him? I said, I just know him professionally. We let it go at that, but anyway. Grooming invariably succeeds when it is fostered by a power.
Excuse me.
Yes, ma'am.
If you hadn't known him that well, or counseled with him or whatever, would you have thought that he was just a nice guy and just trying to get to know your wife? Or
probably.
Did he realize later?
Yes, when I pointed it out to him.
He admitted it.
Oh, when I pointed it out to him. I do this weird kind of thing that's survival for me, and that I don't try to analyze a lot of folks. If we go sit down and have coffee, I'm just going to go sit down and have coffee. You know, I'm not going to do that unless something really strikes me, if one of these internal kinds of... So I probably would have just sat there and just enjoyed it. And actually, it was something that my wife enjoyed. You know, I mean, it was very flattering, because this guy was just... I later told him, I said, you were like a dog in heat. And he said, you're right, I really was. And
but your wife didn't receive it.
Absolutely not. She walked away, you know, kind of with a glow, like you feel when somebody just thinks you're the neatest thing since peanut butter. I mean, it. And for her, I think it was a harmless interaction. I don't think it was as harmful at all. But I do believe that it gets to a point that someone asked yesterday in our session, where sometimes you can be victimized and you have no idea you've been victimized. You know, and just to keep this thing where I keep getting people upset a little bit, you know, we got to barb a little bit. There's a sexual deviance that we work with called frottage, which most of us don't even want to know about. But frottage is a thing that some compulsive sexual deviants work with, where they get in crowded places and rub up against you, and that's what's sexually stimulating to them. You probably never even know that that's happened. So they'll get on buses or something like that and rub themselves against you, and most of their victims have no idea they've been victimized. I'm going to move back to this and ignore a few hints, but I'll be back. So I said the power imbalance in the recipient is vulnerable. Yesterday when I talked, I was much farther along when I said there's always a power imbalance when there's sexual misconduct and someone who's vulnerable. Remember, now we've moved it back into the earlier stages of taking a look at and paying attention. So here I made a statement. It's helped along, and it's fostered in a power imbalance. That example I gave with my wife, I didn't have that one written down. I just happened to think about that. She's up here next week, so I'm going to ask her, how'd you think about that? Because I'd forgotten about that. That one just kind of, and I don't think I've ever discussed this with her. But, I mean, I don't mind. It's not like it. I feel bad about doing that. But in that case, he very rapidly, as I think about it, presented himself as someone who was a very proficient to be. And you dropped a couple of businessy kinds of things to put himself in a more powerful position than my wife, then began flattering her. So he set up a power imbalance and began to work with that. All these behaviors could be appropriate depending on the motivation. Okay, that's all I want to say until I show you the next slide. I want to talk about wedging right now. And as I'm coining these terms, grooming is the setting up, the incremental steps to break it down. Wedging is a term used to describe behavior that isolates individuals. And so sometime I'm probably going to need to change it, because all these art people say, you know, come sit in our class and you can see why I either need to or I gave up a long time ago. That's not my strength. But I put that this is an open communication. It's just an even flow. And when you wedge, it's like this. The offender is here and breaks the communication between either two other individuals or different members of the corporate body. And by that I mean, what will happen when an offender, I think the most graphic examples I think of quickly are youth pastors and school teachers that I've worked with. And in both cases, where the wedging process will take place initially somewhat subtly and then more powerfully, where it'll be like through a listening ear at first, as, now, granted, now what I'm saying is, could be wonderful. You could be, so, you know, you got a 16-year-old at home. I've got 7 kids. You know, I know what it is to go through the battle of survival. And they don't want to talk to you, and so you're so grateful that somebody will listen. But then it can get not so subtle, where the person who's in the offender position will say things like, oh, your mom and dad are kind of stupid anyway, which then builds it more to, you talk to me but don't talk to them. It can go to a point where literally you are told, don't talk to counselors, don't talk to me, I'm the one that really cares about you, I'm the one that will listen to you, I care more about you than your friends do also. You know, so that's getting farther and farther. But that kind of wedging is very important, and it has to tie very closely. And of course, I mean this with adults also. Don't share with your other friends. Let's keep what we're doing secret. Even the fact that we're meeting, because, you know, I am a minister, but I am married, and we're not doing anything wrong anyway, but it would probably be better if you didn't talk to anybody else about this. Let's just keep this between us, and it's our secret. And even the word our has a real grooming process, because now it's something that we're doing. And I've found over and over, when the first kiss happens or the first touch happens, it's let's pray about it, let's see what we've done. But wait a minute, we haven't done anything. He did something, and or manipulated you, or, you know, the victim into initiating the doing. That's where it gets real tricky, because what will happen is there will be a, you know, we're not back in the 60s or 50s when John Wayne was tough. The man of the 80s, is kind of vulnerable and says, gosh, I don't know, I can't get along too good and I'm feeling kind of sad, and you know, so you kiss him, and now we have to pray about this because we have to keep this quiet, because imagine how much it would set up, it would upset everybody else. And what we've done, and it's our relationship, and it's that kind of thing, which is a combination of grooming and wedging, which begins to build and isolate that piece of life. So the secrecy that I talked about yesterday moves the victim into the secrecy also. And of course, it's no different in families than it is in a church, than it is in any corporate group. Some of the devastation that happens to victims is, it's probably hard to believe this unless you just work with it and you hear the same story over and over, where one sister has no idea that the other sister's being abused, or one congregation member has no idea that she's one of 10 or 15, that she's not the only special one who is in a codependent kind of way really helping this poor man through. And am I making some sense? That's where the therapy for the victim becomes so profoundly important, because that's when you get suicidal, when you somehow realize that I did this wonderful, sacramental, sacrificial thing for this person, and I was just one of many. You know, at that point in time, you risk losing values and your faith and everything else, because it's so difficult in that pain to separate. It really is difficult. So this process is so powerful. It's so incredibly powerful that I have a hard time sometimes convincing people that they got set up and it started a long time before. This process often goes on for an offender. This may take a couple of years, you know. It's like a marathon race for the guy who's involved in the process. He's got one going that is at this point, another was at this point, another one at this point, another one at this point. So there's a whole lot of things going at one time. And what makes that work when you talk about the person who's involved in the misconduct is, it's a funny kind of thing, but it's the process that is stimulating. The actual contact always is kind of a letdown, but it's the process of building that eventually this will happen. I'm going to, I'll just refer to this, and I'll spend a lot more time on this on another day. Victims, the recipient of sexual abuse or sexual harassment who experiences a power differential and may feel helpless, vulnerable, or compliant. She or he is unable to make clear decisions or stop the cycle of abuse. And when we get more talking about victims, that's what gets us so difficult. Why people get guilty. Why didn't I stop it? Why was I so stupid? And then we have to work real hard to help people understand how powerful this process is and how skillful some people get at it. And then when we talked yesterday about the need-want continuum, the absolute pressing need that the offender has to do this, you just can't. And if you have a very, very bright man, probably this was John Kennedy's process, you know, and lots of people who are very, very powerful and who have a great need to handle some of the stresses and the pressures that they deal with. Let me jump to a...
Did you see Pretty Woman, right? Yeah.
I did see that, yes.
Is that an example of your power and knowledge?
They sure worked hard in the movie at depicting it as not, but when she made the comment, there was a point in the movie where something like, he said, I've never treated you like a whore, and she said, you just did. She was catching on that, hey, this wasn't all fun and games. I took these grooming steps actually from three school teachers and a youth pastor. It's four people that I worked with. So they don't fit. They don't fit for everything. I'm just trying to get across a point that, but these actually came out of some work that I did. The first step is to notice someone. Everybody that I work with will, in this context, will eventually tell me that when a new class comes or a new group of kids or a new Bible study group or whoever, they'll say, there's somebody I notice right away. I may never do anything for 2 years, but I kind of notice them. They kind of intrigue me. Glances physically in their area, just sort of, you glance a little bit more at one person than another. Talk to them in a group. Now remember, I said, this may happen over a long time, or it could happen very rapidly. But the group breaks up. You're going to watch me now, and you say, who does he go talk to? But you talk to them in a group rather than isolate them initially. Because you know that works better, but you kind of begin to use your position of leadership. Talk to them in a group and touch them very appropriately. Can I touch you very appropriately?
Sure.
See, he's a male, so I'm going to be real safe. So maybe you're talking to the group and you come over and you just like this. And teachers with kids, I want teachers to touch my kids. You know, there's nothing wrong with that, and I like that. In fact, I don't think there's anything wrong with this page. It's the next page where we get a little trickier. But I've put the grooming steps in two pages because depending on the motivation, there's nothing wrong with that. Talk to them alone, but in close proximity of their friends. So maybe they're 10 feet apart. But now see, it's incremental. You're breaking it down. We evolved this process, and it's with variations on the theme. This is the process that gets used. Reinforce them appropriately but consistently somewhat more than the peers. Smiles, hugs, pats, comments, grades, whatever. You know, just a little bit more than the others. One track coach, he couldn't believe that he did it. He didn't realize that he did it. But with four of the girls that he was setting up and grooming, he would send them flowers. But he wouldn't for the other kids. Things like, oh, he sent them in school. I mean, it was like, but he would consistently do it with certain girls and not with other girls. He was a girls' track coach. Isolate them from their peers. See them after class or practice. Have them run errands for you. Have them babysit for you. Have them clean your home. There's nothing wrong with these things in and of themselves, but we're working into a progression of those incremental steps. And then share your dreams with them. Keep it appropriate as if you're motivating them. Isolated settings, walks. I gave a talk to a group of 45 Baptist churches in Seattle several years ago. And I went through all this kind of stuff, and we talked about it. But it's so interesting, and this keeps coming home to me. District leader, or whatever they call in the Baptist churches, it happened to be a Baptist church group, but one of the district leaders came to me a year or so later and talked about someone in the congregation who said the pastor was going on isolated walks with this particular woman. And he said that phrase that you had up on that thing, you gave us this handout, just struck me. And he said, like a year, is that what you were talking about? And then he gave me a whole lot of other information. It was exactly what I was talking about. And there was a sexual misconduct situation, and a whole lot of things got done about it. But it was like he heard it, but he didn't hear it. At any rate, I think that these kinds of steps, they work well. They do get you closer to other people, and they're not necessarily inappropriate. Then I shift it to the next page, which isn't going to get, it's much more blatant than that. The intensity increases. You share your pain and you solicit comfort, which is just a wonderful thing to have someone, particularly someone who's kind of vulnerable and a little codependent, to begin to, and that just doesn't make any difference if you're 39 and he's 52, or you're 13 and he's 29. You know, you talk about you did never make it to state because you tore your hamstring muscle, but you can do it, and I didn't ever get to do it, and my dreams are wrapped up in you, and you know, and all this kind of wonderful stuff that makes people just get very much caring about you and wanting to do anything they can to make you feel better. You share your needs, and I keep referring back to my need-want continuum that I gave yesterday, your perception with them, and you begin to wedge them from others. So this is where it becomes you and me and our relationship much more, and the wedging process begins to move and even gets somewhat more blatant. You isolate by showing attention and wedging. They begin to turn to you and their pain. See, first you started with you turning to them in your pain. That's pretty heady stuff. You know, if I don't know, maybe you laugh at me, but if I went walking here at Holden, which is a wonderful place, and with some of you and started sharing with you some stuff that, you know, just poured my heart out to you, a lot of you, some of you would want to comfort me and make me feel better, and particularly if you've got a process that just sucks right into that stuff real quick, it works. You wedge them from authorities as well as parents, and there's an increased touching. And when I say authorities, you know, don't talk to, don't talk to, don't talk to. You begin to build it. This is our thing. Here, of course, it really moves into a whole different realm. Sexual innuendos, I'll bet you could. Some sexual comments, I'll bet you are. Some sexual comments. And it tends to be a verbal interaction about sexuality at that stage. And the touching really hasn't moved dramatically, although, remember, and I've said this before, it may be that all of this takes place in a week, or it may be that all of this takes place in 2 years. But usually there's some discussion about sexual things. And it may even be along this line of, you know, I'm really scared. Or, you know, I'm a Christian, and I feel even funny talking to you about sex. But, and you get into that, and oh boy, that can get, particularly if the person's vulnerable and has this need to kind of overcome their vulnerability by helping you. Then it moves into inappropriate touching. I didn't go through the cycle, so I can't, that part doesn't mean anything to you. Often followed by remorse, wringing of hands. What should we do? Note the we process. You know, there's a kiss, there's a, that has, you know, there's kisses, and there, that has some sexual implications, or there's a physical touch, or there's something that really crosses that line, which pretty invariably moves to remorse. And, oh my gosh, we shouldn't do this. What are we going to do? Now, that's good for a lot of mileage. You can get together for 5 or 10 times talking about we should never do this again. You know? That's good for a lot of mileage. And it's incredibly intense. And what happens is that some of these words, I get into the jargon, but intensity gets confused for intimacy. And that is so intense to talk about. Anybody that's ever had an affair or had somebody that knows, and I'm not talking about this, although there are elements of this in the affair, but that you're an age-appropriate person with an age-appropriate person, and there's not an imbalance, but you're in an affair, in whatever affair means to you, and you want to stop it, and people will say to me, how do I stop it? And I say, there's only one way. It's like the way I did when I quit smoking. I don't know about you folks, but I used to smoke 2 packs a day. I spent a couple of years trying to quit, and then one day I quit. There isn't any other way to do it. By getting together and talking with the person, it's so intense and so intimate about how we can't do this anymore. And particularly, if we're fighting about it and praying about it and doing all this, you know, it just keeps that thing roaring. So the offender, consciously or unconsciously, uses that, this thing about we must quit and we'll say goodbye one more time and all of that. And it's incredible. It's powerful. It's very, very difficult to break that particular pattern. Now, what I'd like to do for just a minute is ask you to... The thing I want you to walk out of here with today is, and I watched some eyeballs rolling today. Some of you are paying attention to some of this. And it's, I'd like you to grab this little slip of paper. Now, I want everybody to get a slip of paper, and I would like you to write on there, and it doesn't have to be for me, it's as much for you as it is for me, some situation that your intuition says either you know now or you have known in the past about yourself or about somebody else. There's something about this that's not right. I don't feel real good about it. Or it may be that it went through the whole process, but, and I'd like you to write it down, fold it over once, don't put your name on it, and give it to me. I don't want it, but I just want you and then I'll show you what I'd like us to do with that. Some kind of red flag, there was a guy that worked for me and I didn't feel right about it, or whatever, or something in your own, and I'll never point it at you, I would just like you to do that. So will you do that for...
Are there some extra pencils or pens?
Oh my word, no.
Pass them around.
And I've got one pen and it died. It just died. It doesn't work anymore. There's a pen.
Okay. From heaven. Yeah. Like manna.
Just jot something so that I can play with that. Did any of that paper come up that way?
I don't think there's any pencils. I don't think there's any quantity of pencils in here.
In Holden Village, probably.
In this room, anyway.
Well...
How about in the kids' library? What about the reference room for signing out books or something?
Yeah.
How about we forget about this idea?
We're getting them down here.
You know, if I've been thinking about it, well, usually when I do something like this, I take in a whole raft of pencils and they're sitting on my office desk and I don't have a whole raft of pencils.
Can we just be daring and tell about experiences?
Well, maybe that's what we'll do. But I just wanted to be real careful that you got the idea, and I don't want to put anybody on the spot, but what I'd like to do is try to get across an idea that if you're looking at an early prevention or an early intervention, and you look at these steps, then if you go to a rule out, the idea is that if you got some red flags, more often than not, there's nothing wrong with it. Does that make sense? And the only way I know how to check that out is to check it out. And what we tend to do is feel kind of foolish, or we don't want to pay attention to it, or we don't want to bother with it. Or as people often will say to me in school districts or in churches, I can't say anything about that. I might be risking someone's whole career. And so they won't mention anything, which perpetuates the problem. So what I'd like to do is try to set up a little, that's why I set it on paper, which, and I thought in a minute, maybe a couple of people would mention a couple and we could discuss them, and it sounded like we can. But at least on paper, you could mention them and you would have written them to me, and then you know what will probably happen tonight after dinner? You'll come up and talk to me about that and we'll kick it around. Because you'll have gone from here to at least a piece of paper. But I'll just say that one more time. I really believe that if you look at it early enough, probably there's nothing to it, but sometimes there is. And the action step that I'd like you to walk out of here with today is listen to your insides. Pay attention to those kind of steps for yourself or some other people. And I put a whole lot of verbs down there. Either tell or ask or refuse or go or don't go, but do something. It's got to be a do thing. It can't be a thing that later you hear about it and you think, I knew that was weird. I knew, but I didn't ever do anything. Oh, no. So let's talk about it a little bit if you want to. We got a few minutes.
Yeah, mine is too long to write, so I'm glad we can tell about it. And mine was many years ago. I helped a female friend who had MS and was dying. She couldn't eat by herself, so I would go at lunchtime and help her eat. And she eventually died. And in the meantime, her husband had become very, well, I guess you could say he was grooming me, but I don't think it was intentional. I don't know all that. Anyway, after she died, he kept calling me and crying and was very attentive to me, and I became very frightened. And I was also attracted to him. And I thought, oh, my marriage is wrong, it's awful, what is happening? And I stopped the relationship because I couldn't be his friend anymore. I mean, I'm a real friend. I'm very affectionate, I'm very touching, I hug a lot, I cry with my friends, I'm very sensitive. And I'm a people person.
But there was something that just said, I better not do this.
I thought,
there it is.
There's just so many people. But there's a fine line in there where you stop. I mean, the second page that you put up there, you know, I stop at my relationships. I mean, I guess I don't. Well, anyway, back to this other relationship, I had to stop, like you stopped smoking. Because I felt he was really coming on. And he needed me, you know, and in some ways I needed him because I needed him in ways that I wasn't getting from my husband. No one person can give every need to the other person that they need. So I just stopped, and my husband and he remain close friends. But I don't feel funny around him anymore. We don't see him very much. But it was a scary experience. Because I felt attracted, but then realized, what is going on here? And I backed out.
And you did the opposite of what I'm suggesting here, whether it's personal or with other people. You didn't not pay attention to the inside. You listened to it, and you said, oh, I kind of sensed some of my own red flags. Thanks. Yeah. Open forum. Yes.
How can you have this type of red flag without being suspicious of everybody? Maybe they just have a line and that's their way of getting to know people without an alternative motive behind it. You know, I don't be suspicious of everybody you come in contact with.
I don't know.
Not so much for me, but even telling my children or,
And of course the point is, how do you pay attention to this kind of thing and not become suspicious of everybody and put everybody off? And I don't really have a good answer to that. I'm cursed by the fact that I pay attention to these kinds of things, and I'm also blessed by it. I pay a lot of attention. So for instance, I can honestly say that interaction that I mentioned with my wife at Nordstrom's, I don't think I felt bad about it. I observed it because I have some sense of these kinds of processes. I was aware that it's, as far as I could tell, it was time limited, it was harmless, and I didn't go home at night and worry about it. If he would have done anything further, I would have jumped right in the middle of it. I mean, like, called the house or done something like that. I think you'd have more sense of that, but you never know.
How about the guy that doesn't have your expertise? And he puts the move on the guy's wife, and the guy's wife, is in the same position.
Well, that's why I'm going around talking about things like this. People pay more attention. Yes, ma'am?
It seems to me that in answer to your question, that all the things that were on that first page are normal kinds of things that can happen, but it seemed to me the red flag on the second page was the wedging, that when someone tries to separate you and get secretive, the secretiveness and the wedging, that if those would be the red flag areas.
And all through everything I'll say this week, it will always come back to the secretiveness. Although it's fairly easy to pick up here, but when you're in the middle of it, it seems so natural. But pay attention to it, because you're right. Wedging and secretiveness, there's something wrong with that. There's nothing wrong.
So that's where you say, uh-oh, you know, that this is, but before that, all that other stuff is just, can be really nice everyday
can
stuff.
Can be really nice every day. And I would imagine that everybody here, that's the way we integrate ourselves with other people. Nothing wrong with that. That's why I put the line, it's depending on the motivation. What's behind it? And you just pay attention to when it... You know, it's the kind of thing that you intuitively picked up, hopefully, when you were 13 and 14 and you were learning what to do with boys, what not to do with boys. And some people learn it real well and some people don't. Yes?
I'm a teacher in high school, and twice in my career I've seen very young men teachers get involved with students, young women. And I feel like that's definitely misconduct because of the power differential. I don't care if they're only 4 years of age difference.
Right.
It is a very grave, serious difference in power. And what I wonder about is if that is does that necessarily become a pattern, or can that sort of thing be? I mean, people would argue, well, it was just one time. He grew out of it. He grew up. He was confused. She was young. Blah 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 blah. Or is that something that you would be uncomfortable? That one should be uncomfortable about and pay close attention to that man as he gets older. Is that going to happen one time and never happen again?
Sure. Well, I like to think that there are some things we can do about that, and I like to try to catch it early enough that it is the first time rather than the 52-year-old principal that I worked with that was like the 400th time, you know, those kinds of things. I do believe we can do some things about that. I don't think it's, and I didn't hear you saying this, that it's simple or, you know, there's some real needs that the 23-year-old teacher has with the 16-year-old that he's meeting that are pretty basic to him, that he gets into that power differential kind of thing, you know. Why isn't he going out with other 23-year-old teachers? And I don't think that makes him evil, but I think there are some things that we really need to address and get right in the middle of, and I'm not sure that he ought to be in a position of teaching, or at least for a while. But, you know, there are some things we can do about that. I mean, there is some restoration here, but we've got to get a crack at it. And most people that I work with that get really involved in that process, particularly the young and haven't done it a lot, they have a hard time seeing that there's really anything wrong with it. They think you're just an old fuddy-duddy who...
Well, yeah, a lot of other people think that you're a fuddy-duddy if you object to it very strenuously. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a character flaw and all these things. It's